Europeans the day after tomorrow, we firstlings of the 20th century, with all our dangerous curiosity, our multifariousness of perfect disguising, our mellow and seemingly sweet and cruelty in sense and spirit, we shall presumably, if we must have virtues, have the longing which will come to agreement with our most secret and heartfelt inclinations, with our most ardent requirements. Well, then, let us look for them in our labyrinths, where, as we know, so many things lose themselves, so many things get quite lost. And is there anything finer than to search for one's own virtues? Is it not almost to believe in one's own virtues? But this believing in one's own virtues, is it not practically the same as what was formerly called one's good conscience? That long, respectable pigtail of an idea that their grandfathers used to hang behind their heads, and often enough also behind their understandings. It seems, therefore, that however little we may imagine ourselves to be old-fashioned and grandfatherly respectable in other respects, in one thing, we are nevertheless the worthy grandchildren of our grandfathers, we last Europeans with good consciences. We also still wear the pigtail. Ah, if you only knew how soon, so very soon, it will be different. As in the stellar firmament, there are sometimes two suns which determine the path of one planet, and in certain cases suns of different colors shine around a single planet, now with red light, now with green, and then simultaneously illumined and flooded with motley colors. So we modern men, owing to the complicated mechanism of our firmament, are determined by different moralities. Our actions shine alternately in different colors, and are seldom unequivocal. And there are often cases, also, in which our actions are motley colored. To love one's enemies? I think that has been well learned. It takes place thousands of times at present, on a large and small scale, indeed at times the higher and sublimer thing takes place, we learn to despise what we love, and precisely when we love best. All of it, however, unconsciously, without noise, without ostentation, with the shame and secrecy of good was advancing my father's religion and humanity finally became opposed to their taste, including the enmity and Wolfsonian bickerings against religion. And all that formerly belonged to free thinker Pantomime. It is the music in our conscience, the dance in our spirit, to which Puritan movements, moral ceremonies, and goodness will challenge. Let us be careful in dealing with those who attach great importance to being credited with moral tact and subtlety of moral discernment. They never forgive us if they have once made a mistake before us, or even with regard to us. They inevitably become our instinctive calumniators and detractors, even when they still remain our friends. Blessed are the forgetful, for they get the better, even of their blunders. The psychologists of France, and where else are there still psychologists nowadays, have never yet exhausted their bitter and manifold enjoyment of the petite bourgeois, just as though they betray something thereby. Flaubert, for instance, the honest citizen of Rouen, neither saw, heard, nor tasted anything else in the end. It was his mode of self-torment and refined cruelty. As this is growing wearisome, I would now recommend for a change something else for a pleasure, namely the unconscious astuteness with which good, fat, honest mediocrity always behaves towards loftier spirits and the tasks they have to perform. The subtle, barbed, Jesuitical astuteness, which is a thousand times subtler than the taste and understanding of the middle class in its best moments. Subtle. favor of revenge is the intellectually shallow on those who are less so. It is also a kind of indemnity for their being badly endowed by nature. And finally, it is an opportunity for acquiring spirit and becoming subtle. Now this spiritual means they are glad in most part there is a standard according to which those who are over-endowed with intellectual means and privileges are equal to them. They contend for the equality of all before God, and almost need the belief in God for this purpose. It is among them the most powerful antagonists of atheism are found. If anyone were to say to them, a lofty spirituality is beyond all comparison with the honesty and respectability of a merely moral man, it would make them furious. I shall take care of not to say so. I would rather flatter them with my theory that lofty spirituality itself exists only as the ultimate product of moral qualities, that it is a synthesis of all qualities attributed to the merely moral man. After they have been acquired singly through long training and practice, perhaps during a whole series of generations, that lofty spirituality is precisely the spiritualizing justice and the beneficent severity which knows that it is authorized to maintain gradations of rank in the world, even among things, and not only among men. Now that the praise of the disinterested person is so popular, one must, probably not without some danger, get an idea of what people actually take an interest in, and what are the things generally which fundamentally and profoundly concern ordinary men, including the cultured, even the learned, and perhaps philosophers also, if appearances do not deceive. The fact thereby becomes obvious that the greater part of what interests and charms higher natures and more refined and fastidious tastes seems absolutely uninteresting to the average man, if, notwithstanding, he perceives devotion to these interests. He calls it desinteresse, and wonders how it is possible to act disinterestedly. There have been philosophers who could give this popular astonishment a seductive and mystical, other keep in an action for love's sake shall be unegoistic. The two fools and the crazy self-sacrificer. But whoever has really offered sacrifice knows that he wanted and obtained something for it. Perhaps something from himself, for something from himself, that he relinquished here in order to have more there. Perhaps in general to be more, or even feel himself more. This is the realm of questions and answers in which a more fastidious spirit would not like to stay. For here truth has to stifle her yawns so much that she is obliged to answer. And, after all, truth is a woman. One must not use force with her. It sometimes happens, said a moralistic pedant and trifling man, that I honor and respect an unselfish man, not, however, because he is unselfish, but because I think he has a right to be useful to another man at his own expense. In short, the question is always who he is and who the other is. For instance, when a person created and destined for man, self-denial and modest retirement instead of being virtues would be the waste of virtues. So it seems to me. Every system of unegoistic morality which takes itself unconditionally and appeals to everyone not only sins against good taste, but is also an incentive to sins of omission, an additional seduction under the mask of philanthropy, and precisely a seduction and injury to the higher, rarer, and more privileged types of men. Moral systems must be compelled, first of all, to bow before the gradations of rank. Their presumption must be driven home to their conscience until they thoroughly understand, at last, that it is immoral to say that what is right for one proper for another. So said moralistic pedant Bayan. Did he perhaps deserve to be laughed at when he thus exhorted systems of morals to practice morality? But one should not be too much in the right if one wishes to have the laughers on one's own side. A grain of wrong contains even to good taste. be sure he notices that none of the costumes fit him properly. Changes and changes. Let us look at the 19th century with respect. These hasty preferences and changes in the masquerades of style, and also with respect to the moments of desperation that have nothing seeking us. It is in vain to get ourselves up as romantic, or classical, or Christian, or Florentine, or Baroque, or national, in moribus et artibus. It does not clothe us, but the spirit, especially the historical spirit, profits even by this desperation. Once and again, a new sample of the past or of the foreign is tested, put on, taken off, packed up, and above all, studied. We are the first studious age in the people of costumes. I mean, as concerns morals, articles of belief, artistic tastes, and religions. We are prepared, as no other age has ever been, for a carnival in grand style, for the most spiritual festival, laughter and arrogance, for the transcendental height of supreme folly and aristophanic ridicule of the world. Still discovering the domain of our invention just here, the domain where even we can still be original, probably as parodists of the world's history and as God's Mary Andrews. Perhaps, though nothing else of the present had a future, our laughter itself may have a future. The historical sense, or the capacity for defining quickly the order of rank and evaluation or an individual has lived, the divining instinct for the relationships of these valuations, for the relation of the authority of the valuations to the authority of the operating forces, this historical sense, which we Europeans claim as our own specialty, has come to us in the train of the enchanting and mad semi-barbarity into which Europe has been plunged by the democratic mingling of classes and races. It is only the 19th century that has recognized this faculty as its sixth sense. Owing to this mingling, the past of every form and mode of life and of cultures which were formerly closely contiguous and superimposed on one another flows forth into us modern souls. Our instincts now run back in all directions. We ourselves are a kind of In the end, as we have said, the spirit perceives its advantage therein. By means of our semi-barbarian body and his desire, we have secret access everywhere, such as a noble age never had. We have access, above all, to the labyrinth of perfect civilizations and to every form of semi-barbarity that has at any time existed on Earth. And insofar as the most considerable part of human civilization hitherto has just been semi-barbarity, the historical sense implies almost the sense and instinct for everything, the taste and tongue for everything, whereby it immediately proves itself to be an ignoble sense. For instance, we enjoy Homer once more. It is perhaps our happiest acquisition that we know how to appreciate Homer, who men of distinguished culture, as the French in the 17th century, like Saint-Amand, who reproached him for his esprit vaste, and even Voltaire, the last emperor of the century, cannot and could not so easily appropriate, whom they scarcely permitted themselves to enjoy. The very decided yea and nay of their palate, their promptly ready disgust, their hesitating reluctance with regard to everything strange, their horror of the bad taste, even of lively curiosity, and in general the averseness of every distinguished and self-sufficing culture to avow a new desire, a dissatisfaction with its own condition, or an admiration of what is strange, all this determines and disposes them unfavorably even towards the best things in the world that are not their property, but could not become their prey. And no faculty is more unintelligible to such men than just this historical sense, with its truculent, plebeian curiosity. The case is not different with Shakespeare, that marvelous Spanish, Moorish, Saxon synthesis of taste, over whom an ancient Athenian of the circle of Aeschylus would have half killed himself with laughter or irritation. But we accept precisely this wild mockingness, this medley of the most delicate, the most coarse, and the most artificial, with a secret confidence of cordiality. We enjoy it as a refinement of art reserved expressly for us, and allow ourselves to be as little disturbed by the repulsive fumes in the proximity of the English populace in which Shakespeare's art and taste lives, as perhaps and we can only evoke in ourselves imperfectly, hesitatingly, and with compulsion of small, short, and happy glutsings of glorification of human life as we shine here and there. Those moments when the martyr is experiencing when great power has voluntarily come to a halt before the boundless and infinite. When a superabundance of refined delight has been enjoyed by a sudden checking and petrifying, by standing firmly and connecting oneself fixedly while still trembling on the ground. Proportionateness is strange to us. Let us confess it to ourselves. Our itching is really the itching for the infinite, the immeasurable. Like the rider on his forward panting horse, we let the reins fall before the infinite, we modern men descend our bearings. And we're only in our highest bliss when we are in the most danger. 225. Whether it be hedonism, pessimism, utilitarianism, eudaimonism, all those modes of thinking which measure the worth of things according to pleasure and pain, that is, according to accompanying circumstances and secondary considerations, are plausible modes of thought and naiveties which everyone conscious of creative powers and the artist's conscience will look down upon with scorn, although not without sympathy. Sympathy for you? To be sure, that is not sympathy as you understand it. It is not sympathy for social distress, for society with its sick and misfortunate, for the hereditarily vicious and defective who lie on the ground around us. Still less is it sympathy for grumbling, vexing, revolutionary slave classes who strive after power. They call it freedom. Our sympathy is a loftier and further sighted sympathy. We see how a man dwarfs himself, how you dwarf him. And there are moments when you view your sympathy with an indescribable anguish when we resist it, when we regard your seriousness as more dangerous than any kind of levity. You want, if possible, and there is nothing more foolish, if possible, to do away with suffering. And we, it really seems that we would rather have it increased and made worse than it has ever been. Well-being, as you understand it, is certainly not a goal. It seems to us an end. he not that it is only this discipline that has produced all the elevation humanity hitherto? The tension of soul and misfortune which communicates to it energy, its shuddering when you feel it racked and ruined, its inventiveness and bravery of undergoing and enduring, interpreting and exploring misfortune. And whatever depth, mystery, disguise, spirit, artifice, or greatness has been bestowed upon the soul, has it not been bestowed through suffering, through the discipline of great suffering? In man, creature, and creator are united. In man there is not only matter, shred, excess, clay, mire, folly, chaos. There is also the creator, the sculptor, the hardness of the hammer, the divinity of the sculptor. On the seventh day, do you understand this contrast? And that your sympathy for the creature in man applies to that which has to be fashioned, bruised, forged, stretched, roasted, annealed, refined, to that which must necessarily suffer and is meant to suffer. And our sympathy, do you not understand what our reverse sympathy applies to, when it resists your sympathy as the worst of all tampering and enervation? So it is sympathy against the sympathy. But to repeat it once more, there are higher problems than the problems of pleasure and pain and sympathy. And all systems of philosophy which deal only with these are naivetes. We immoralists, this world with which we are concerned, in which we have to fear and love, this almost invisible, inaudible world of delicate commands and delicate obedience, a world with almost every respect, conscious, insidious, sharp, and tender. Yes, it is well protected from clumsy spectators and familiar curiosity. threatening it is the virtue of which we cannot rid ourselves. We free spirits. Well, we will labor at it with all our perversity and love, and not tire of perfecting ourselves in our virtue, which alone remains. May its glance someday overspread unto gilded mocking twilight, this aging civilization with its dull, mean seriousness. And if, nevertheless, our honesty should one day grow weary and sigh and stretch its limbs and find us too hard and would fain have it pleasanter, easier, and gentler, like an agreeable vice, let us remain hard, we latest stoics, and let us send to its help whatever devil we have in us. I'm disgusted at the folly of undefined, our nitimur invitatum, our lover's etcher, our sharp and fastidious curiosity, our more subtle, disguised, intellectual will to power and universal conquest, which rambles and roars invidiously around all the realms of the future. Let us go with all our devils to the help of our God. It is probable that people will misunderstand and mistake us on that account. What does it matter? They will say, their honesty, that is their devilry and nothing else. What does it matter? And even if they were right, have not all gods hitherto been such sanctified, rebaptized devils? And after all, what do we know of ourselves? And what the spirit that leads us wants to be called? It is a question of names. And how many spirits we harbor? Our honesty, you free spirits, let us be careful, lest it become our vanity, our ornament and ostentation, our limitation, our stupidity. Every virtue inclines to stupidity, every stupidity to virtue. Stupid to the point of sanctity, or so Russia. Let us be careful, lest, out of pure honesty, we eventually become saints and bores. Is not life 100 times too short for us to bore ourselves? One would have to believe in eternal life in order to. I hope to be forgiven for discovering that all moral philosophy hitherto has been tedious It is desirable that as few people as possible should reflect upon morals, and consequently, it is very desirable that morals should not someday become interesting. Let us not be afraid. Things still remain today as they have always been. I see no one in Europe who has or discloses an idea of fact, but philosophizing concerning morals might be conducted in a dangerous, captious, and ensnaring manner. That calamity might be involved. Observe, for example, the indefatigable, inevitable English utilitarians, how ponderously and respectably they stalk on, stalk along of American metaphor versus better, in the footsteps of Bentham. Just as he had already stopped in the footsteps of the respectable Helvetius. No, he was not a dangerous man, Helvetius, sinceritur procurant, to use an expression of Galliani. No, he thought nothing of the nature of a finer term or better expression of an old thought, not even a proper history of what has been previously thought on the subject, an impossible literature, taken all in all, unless one knows how to leaven it with some mischief. In effect, the old English vice called cant, which is moral pantufism, has insinuated itself also into these moralists, whom one must certainly read in light of their motives if one must read them. Conceal this time under the new form of the science. Spirit. Moreover, there is not absent from them a secret struggle with the pangs of conscience, from which the race of former Puritans must naturally suffer in all their scientific tinkering with morals. Is not a moralist the opposite of a Puritan? That is to say, as a thinker who regards morality as questionable, as worthy of interrogation, in short, as a problem, is moralizing not immoral? In the end, they all want English morality to be recognized as authoritative, inasmuch as mankind, with a general utility, with the happiness of the greatest number, no, the happiness of England, would be best served thereby. They would like, by all means, to convince themselves that the striving after English happiness, I mean after comfort and fashion, and in the highest instance, a seat in Parliament, is at the same time the true path of virtue. In fact, that insofar as there has been virtue in the world hitherto, not one of the harmless, conscience-stricken, hurting animals who undertake to advocate the cause of egoism as conducive to the general welfare, wants to have any knowledge or inkling of the facts that the general welfare is no ideal, no goal, no notion that can be at all grasped, but is only a nostrum, that what is fair to one may not at all be fair to another, that the requirement of one morality for all is really a detriment to higher men. In short, that there is a distinction of rank between man and man, and consequently between morality and morality. They are an unassuming and fundamentally mediocre species of men, and, as already remarked, insofar as they are tedious, one cannot think highly enough of their utility. One ought even to encourage them, as has been partially attempted in the following rhymes. They are eagles, bearer, longer, better, eye revealing, stiffer eye, head and knee, unenraptured, never jesting, mediocre, everlasting, songing, insulting. Later ages, which may be proud of their humanity, there still remains so much fear, so much superstition of fear, of the cruel wild beast, the master of which constitutes the very pride of these human ages, that even obvious truths, as if by the agreement of centuries, have long remained unuttered, because they have the appearance of helping the finally slain wild beast back to life again. I perhaps risk something when I allow such truth to escape. Let others capture it again. Give it so much milk and pie sentiment. Footnote. An expression from Schiller's William Tell, Act 4, Scene 3. Let others capture it again and give it so much milk and pie sentiment. That it will lie down quiet and forgotten in its own corner. One ought to learn anew about cruelty and open one's eyes. One ought at last to learn impatience. lives, it flourishes, it must only be transfigured. That which constitutes the painful delight of tragedy is cruelty. That which operates supremely in so-called tragic sympathy and at the basis even of everything sublime, up to the highest and most delicate thrills of metaphysics, obtains its sweetness solely from the intermingled ingredient of cruelty. What the Roman enjoys in the arena, the Christian in the ecstasies of the cross, spends at the sight of the faggot and stake of the bullfight. The present-day Japanese who presses his way to the tragedy, the workman of the Parisian suburbs who has a homesickness for bloody revolutions, the Wagnerian who, with unhinged will, undergoes the performance of Tristan and Isolde. What all these enjoy and strive with mysterious ardor to drink in is the filter of the great Xerxes' cruelty. Here, to be sure, we must put aside entirely the blundering psychology of former times, which could only teach with regard to cruelty that it originated at the sight of the suffering of others. There is an abundant, superabundant enjoyment even in one's own suffering, causing his own suffering. And wherever man has allowed himself to be persuaded to self-denial in the religious sense, or the self-mutilation, as among the Phoenicians and the ascetics, or in general to desensualization, decarnalization, and contrition, the puritanical repentance vows, so vivisection of conscience, and the Pascal-like sacrificia del intellecto. He is secretly allured and impelled forwards by his cruelty, by the dangerous thrill of cruelty towards himself. Finally, let us consider that even the seeker of knowledge operates as an artist and glorifier of cruelty, and that he compels the spirit to proceed against its own inclination, and often enough against the wishes of his heart. He forces it to say nay when he would like to affirm love and adore. Indeed, every instance of taking a thing profoundly and fundamentally is a violation, an intentional injury of the fundamental will of the spirit, requirements and capacities are the same as those assigned by physiologists to everything that lives, grows, and multiplies. The power of the spirit to appropriate foreign elements reveals itself in a strong tendency to assimilate the new to the old, to simplify the manifold, to overlook or repudiate its absolutely contradictory. Just as it arbitrarily re-underlines, makes prominent, and falsifies for itself certain traits and lines and foreign elements in every portion of the outside world. Its object, thereby, is the incorporation of new experiences, the assortment of new things in the old arrangements, in short, growth, or, more properly, the feeling of growth, the feeling of increased power in its object. This same will has at its service an apparently opposed impulse of the spirit, suddenly adopt a preference of ignorance, arbitrary shutting out, a closing of windows, an inner denial of this or that, a prohibition to approach, a sort of defensive attitude against much that is knowable, a contentment with obscurity, with the shutting in horizon, an acceptance approval of ignorance as that which is all necessary according to the degree of its appropriating power, its digestive power, to speak figuratively. And in fact, the spirit resembles the stomach more than anything else. Here also belong an occasional propensity of the spirit to let itself be deceived, perhaps with a waggish suspicion that it is not so and so, but is only allowed to pass as such, a delight in uncertainty and ambiguity, and an exulting enjoyment of arbitrary, out-of-the-way narrowness in the mystery, of the too near, of the foreground, of the magnified, the diminished, the misshapen, the beautified, an enjoyment of the arbitrariness of all these manifestations of power. Finally, in this connection, there is the not unscrupulous readiness of the spirit to deceive other spirits and dissemble before them, the constant pressing and straining of a creating, shaping, changeable power. The spirit enjoys therein its craftiness, its variety of disguises, and enjoys also its feeling of security therein. It is precisely by its protean arts that it is best protected and concealed. Counter to this propensity for appearance, for simplification, for disguise, for a cloak, in short, sight rush to me, but he had sharpened and hardened his eyes sufficiently long for introspection, and been accustomed to severe discipline, and even severe words. He will say, "Here is something cruel in the tendency of thy spirit. Let the virtuous and amiable try to convince him that it is not so." In fact, it would sound nicer if, instead of our cruelty, perhaps our extravagant honesty whispered about and glorified. We free very few spirits, and someday perhaps such will actually be a posthumous glory. Meanwhile, for there is plenty of time until then, we should be ourselves out in such florid and fringed moral verbiage. Our whole former work has just made us sick of this taste and its sprightly exuberance. They are beautiful, listening, genial, festive words. Honesty, love of truth, wisdom, sacrifice for knowledge, heroism of the truthful. There is something in them that makes one's heart swell with pride. We anchorites and marmots have long ago persuaded ourselves in all the secrecy of an anchorite's conscience that this worthy parade of verbiage also belongs to the old false adornment, frippery, and gold dust of unconscious human vanity, and that even under such flattering color and repayment, the terrible original text, Homo Natura, must again be recognized. In effect, to translate man back again into nature, to master the many vain visionary interpretations and subordinate meanings that have hitherto been scratched and daubed with the eternal original. invited to his throne to exit the literally there merely my truths. This is one of the worst developments in the general unglified Europe. For what must these clumsy attempts at feminine scientific gravity and self-exposure bring to light? Woman has so much cause for shame. Woman, there is so much pedantry, superficiality, schoolmasteriness, petty presumption, unbridledness, and indiscretion concealed, studied over years behavior towards children. This must really be best restrained and dominated hitherto by the fear of man. Alas, it ever be eternally tedious in a woman. She has plenty of it, is allowed to venture forth. If she begins radically and on principle to unlearn her wisdom, alleviating and taking easily, if she forgets her delicate aptitude for agreeable desires, female voices are already raised, which, by some of their Aristophanes, make one afraid. Medical explicitness is a state of threatening manner that a woman first and last requires for a man. Is it not in the very worst case that a woman sets herself up to be scientific? Enlightenment hitherto has fortunately been men's affair, men's gift. We remain therewith among ourselves, and in the end, in view of all the learning right about woman, we may well have considerable doubt as to whether woman really desires and desire. If woman does not thereby seek an ornament for herself, I believe ornamentation belongs to the eternally feminine. Why not at all by us. We then said, will you not continue to compromise yourself by enlightening us, just as it demands care and consideration for a woman in the church decreed Mullier to say it in the Ecclesia. It was to the benefit of women when Napoleon gave two eloquent madams there to understand. Mullier to say it in Politicis. And in my opinion, he is a true friend of women. Also to women today, Mulier Tessier de Muliero. It betrays corruption of the instincts, apart from the fact that it betrays bad taste when a woman refers to Madame Lalonde, or Madame Estelle, or Monsieur Jorissand, as though something was proved thereby in favor of woman as she is. Among men, these are the three comical women as they are, nothing more. Best involuntary counter-argument against feminine emancipation and equality. Stupidity in the kitchen. Woman as cook. The terrible thoughtlessness with which the feeding of the family and the master of the house is managed. Woman does not understand what food means, and she insists on being a cook. And woman has a thinking creature. She should certainly, as cook for thousands of years, have discovered the most important physiological facts, and should likewise have got possession of the healing art. Through bad female cooks, through the entire lack of reason in the kitchen, the development of mankind has been longest retarded and most interfered with. Even today, matters are very dire. A word to high school girls. There are turns and casts of fancy. There are sentences, little handfuls of words in which a whole culture, a whole society suddenly crystallizes itself. Among these is the incidental remark of Madame de Lambert to her son. Mon ami, ne vous permettez jamais que votre famille vous fera grand plaisir. The motherliest and wisest remark, by the way, that was ever addressed to the son. I have no doubt that every noble woman will oppose what Dante and Goethe believe about women. stressful every day. Discreet. Whom I thank when in my place? God. And my good horse. Young. A fly decked cavern. Old. A dragon. Noble's title, language fine, man as well, were he mine. Speech in brief, sense in mass, slippery for many pass. Woman has hitherto been treated by men like birds, which, losing their way, have come down among them from an elevation, and something delicate, fragile, wild, strange, sweet, and animating. But a something also which must be up, gently flying away. To be mistaken is a fundamental problem of man and woman. Neither is the profoundest antagonism and the necessity for eternally hostile tension. To dream here, perhaps, of equal rights, equal training, equal claims and obligations, that is a typical sign of shallow-mindedness. And the thinker who has proved himself shallow at this danger spot, shallow in instinct, may generally be regarded as suspicious, nay more, as betrayed, as discovered. He will probably prove too short for all fundamental questions of life, future as well as present, and will be unable to descend into any of the depths. On the other hand, a man with depth of spirit as well as of desires, and has also the depth of benevolence which is capable of severity and harshness, may even be confounded with them, can only think of woman as Orientals do. He must conceive of her as a possession, as confinable property, as being predestined for service, and accomplishing the mission therein. He must take his stand in this matter upon the immense rationality of Asia, upon the superiority of the instinct of nature, as the Greeks did formerly. Those What is more difficult to understand is that precisely thereby woman deteriorates. This is what is happening nowadays. Let us not deceive ourselves about it. Wherever the industrial spirit has triumphed over the military aristocratic spirit, woman strives for the economic and legal independence of the clerk. Woman has clerked us, is inscribed in the clerk of the modern society, which is in the course of formation. While she thus appropriates new rights, aspires to be master, and inscribes progress on her flags and banners, the very office realizes itself with terrible obviousness. Woman retrogrades. Since the French Revolution, the influence of woman in Europe has declined in proportion as she has increased her rights and claims. And the emancipation of woman, insofar as it is desired and demanded by women themselves, and not only by masculine shallow types. This proves to be a remarkable symptom of the increasing weakening and deadening of the most womanly instincts. There is stupidity in this movement, an almost masculine stupidity, of which a well-meaning man, who is always a sensible woman, might be heartily ashamed. To lose the intuition as to the ground upon which you can surely achieve victory, neglect exercise and the use of the proper weapons, to let herself go before a man, perhaps even to the book, where formerly she kept herself in control and in refined, artful humility. To neutralize within the virtuous audacity of man's faith in a veiled, fundamentally different ideal of woman, something eternally, necessarily feminine. To emphatically and loquaciously dissuade man from the idea that woman must be preserved, cared for, protected, and indulged, like some delicate, strangely wild, and often pleasant domestic animal. The clumsy and indignant collection of everything in nature, servitude and bondage, puts the position of woman hitherto existing order of society has entailed, and still entails, as though slavery were a counter-argument, and not rather a condition of every higher culture, of every elevation of culture. What does all this betoken, if not a disintegration of womanly instincts, of defeminizing? Certainly there are enough of idiotic friends and corruptors of women among the learned asses of the masculine sex who advise women to obnoxious or ludicrous to a profound godless man. Almost everywhere, nerves are being ruined by the most morbid and dangerous kind of music. The latest German music achieves daily being made more hysterical and more incapable of fulfilling the first and last function than of bearing robust children. They wish to cultivate her in general still more, and intend, as they say, to make the weaker sex strong by culture, as if history would not teach in the most emphatic manner the cultivating of mankind and his weakening, that is to say, the weakening, dissipating, and languishing of his force of will, have always kept pace with one another, and that the most powerful and influential women in the world, and lastly, the mother of Napoleon, had just to thank their force of will, and not their schoolmasters, for their power and ascendancy over men. That which inspires respect in woman, and often enough fear also, is her nature, which is more natural than that of man. Her genuine, carnivora-like, cunning flexibility, her tiger claws beneath her glove, her naivete and egoism, her untrainableness and innate wildness, her incomprehensibleness, extent, and deviation of her desires and virtues. That which, in spite of fear, excites one's sympathy for the dangers of a beautiful cat, woman, is that she seems more afflicted, more vulnerable, more necessitous of love, and more condemned to disillusionment than any other creature. Fear and sympathy it is with these feelings that man has hitherto stood in the presence of woman, always with one foot already in tragedy, which rends while it delights. What? And all that is now to be at its end? And the distant champion of woman is in progress? The tediousness of woman is slowly evolving? Oh, Europe, Europe, we know the horned animal which is always most attractive to thee, from which danger is ever again threatening thee. Thy old favorite might once more become history, and immense stupidity might once again overmaster thee and carry thee away, and no god concealed beneath it. No, only an idea, a model.